Christopher Cotter, and what you're about to listen to is one of five podcasts which the Religious Studies Project is presenting in association with the Non-Religion and Secularity Research Network. For those of you who don't know the Religious Studies Project, please take a moment to survey religiousstudiesproject.com, which features a few dozen of our weekly podcasts with leading international scholars on exciting developments in theory, method, and empirical study within the social scientific study of religion. In addition, there are roundtable discussions, book reviews, feature essays, opportunities digests, and more. For those of you who don't know the NSRN, it's an international and interdisciplinary network of researchers founded in 2008, which aims to centralize existing research on the topic of non-religion and secularity, and to facilitate discussion in this area. The NSRN run a series of events, including their biennial conference and annual lecture series, in addition to maintaining a vibrant website with extensive collections of resources, publications, and listings for teachers and students working in the area of non-religion and secularity. You can check out their website at www.nsrn.net. As the Religious Studies Project has a wider remit than this, we didn't want to fill all our listeners' inboxes with five quite lengthy podcasts, and therefore we've not made these available through iTunes. However, they are available on our website and are linked to from the NSRN's website. Due to the lecture style of these recordings, it's somewhat inevitable that the audio quality will be lower than we would like, and that there might be references to PowerPoint presentations or other events happening in the room. However, we know that these will be minor irritations when compared with the stimulating scholarship that you're about to hear, and we're very grateful to the NSRN for working with us to bring you these lectures. This podcast in particular is a lecture delivered by Monica Volrab-Saar entitled Multiple Secularities Toward a Cultural Sociology of Secular Religious Distinctions. This was one of the keynote lectures at the NSRN's 2012 conference at Goldsmiths University of London in July. Monica Volrab-Saar is Professor of Cultural Sociology at the University of Leipzig in Germany, with an interest in secularization, Islam and Western societies, and qualitative methodology. In addition to many papers in German, she's also published in English, and these publications include the articles Secularization as Conflict in Social Compass, 2008, The Stable Third, Non-Religiosity in Germany, in What the World Believes, Analyses and Commentary on the Religion Monitor 2008, edited by Bertelsmann Siftum 2009, and Contested Secularities, Religious Minorities and Secular Progressivism in the Netherlands, in the Journal of Religion in Europe 2012. The other four lectures which are available on the Religious Studies Project website are John Landman's NSRN Annual Lecture from April 2011, entitled Atheism Explained, The Evolutionary Origins of Atheistic Thought, and the other three lectures from the 2012 NSRN Conference, Callum Brown on The People of No Religion, Humaira Iktidar on Secularization and Non-Religion in Non-Western Contexts, and Grace Davey on Belief and Unbelief, Two Sides of a Coin. For now, I'm going to pass you over to Monica and apologise that my own technical incompetence meant that we lost the first 30 seconds or so of this lecture.
The previous research on the secularisation process in the GDR and its subjective appropriation that was one of the articles about this was just mentioned. In this research, we reconstructed a pattern that we labelled, and I actually have to use the German title, Forcierte Säkularität, because it actually works better in German than in English, since forciert has this double meaning of outer force and inward force, whereas the English sounds like it was only sort of pushed from above. This is not what we mean. From that emerged the idea of developing a comparative cultural sociology of secularity that goes beyond identifying exceptions from Western European or North American patterns. And within that, the variant of forced secularity should not simply be reduced to the dictatorial conditions of its development, but should also be understood in its specific structure of meaning and should be embedded in a typology of secularities. When we attempted this GDR secularity, which seems so exceptional in a global perspective, moved into relative proximity to other types of secularity, even in Western Europe, for example, the French one. Based on this idea of comparative secularities, we wrote a project proposal on multiple secularities, for which we finally got funding by the Saxon Ministry of Science and Art. The funding has ended recently, whereas the research has certainly not come to an end, and it rather seems to become a live project, but I'm not sure if funding institutions will find this a convincing argument. This project has two specificities which distinguish it from other types of research. On the one side, it is explorative in its character, but rather broad in its scope. We have chosen four different countries in order to explore the relevant lines of distinction with regard to religion and secularity and to identify the important levels of analysis. The second characteristic was that we wanted to examine the plausibility of a model that we had sketched out tentatively in the beginning based on our own previous research as well as on the research of others, and to refine it or, if necessary, to revise it. This model describes four ideal types of secularity in their relation to each other. I will elaborate on this more closely. Of course, both interests cannot be realized without doing real research. So we ended up doing a series of expert interviews in the four countries I mentioned, in the four countries in India, the Netherlands, South Africa, and the United States. We studied jurisdictions, public debates, and media reporting, and of course, we read a lot of existing studies. Today, I will mainly focus on the general idea of this project. When I refer to the countries, it mainly serves as an illustration of the general concept, but of course, the plausibility of the concept has to be proven with reference to its embedding in real life. But let me start with a rough sketch of the newer debate on the issue of religion and secularity in modern societies. Over the past decades, sociological debates have problematized long-cherished assumptions of process theories in the social sciences. This concerns the classical version of modernization theory with its assumptions regarding convergence and diffusion, as well as the theory of secularization. It was expected that the worldwide spread of the concepts of a nation-state, parliamentary democracy, the rule of law, the liberal market economy, and rational science would give rise to a similar model of social organization in which religion would be largely confined to the private domain. In addition, it seemed obvious that an increase in the economic standard of living and in existential security would go hand in hand with a reduction in religious participation and belief. Although these classical variants of modernization theory have not disappeared from the scene and can still claim a certain degree of plausibility, they have nevertheless lost the dominant status they once enjoyed. A wide-ranging controversy over the assumptions of classical modernization theory was conducted both among social scientists as well as historians. Within this controversy, the long dominant position of convergence theorists is increasingly being superseded by approaches that assume different developmental paths as a permanent feature. This new orientation has found prominent expression in the debate over multiple modernities. In this concept, on the one hand, a minimal unifying concept of modernity is maintained, but on the other, an enduring diversity of developmental path is assumed. The latter is explained in terms of divergences in the development of the so-called axial age cultures, though also in terms of their respective histories of interaction with the Western concept of modernity. A parallel development can be observed in the discussion over secularization. Although here attempts were made from early on to identify different paths of secularization, These were initially motivated by the intention of developing a general theory of secularization, as David Martin has named it, and discovering the conditions of exceptions to the general model. In the meantime, however, an awareness of enduring differences developed here as well, and was theoretically articulated as a necessity of a thoroughgoing historicization of the secularization debate. Concerns with a variety of secularization were heightened by José Casanova into a fundamental critique of the theoretical idea that three rather distinct processes are necessarily linked: functional differentiation, the decline of subjective religiosity, and the privatization of religion. However, although Casanova at first still regarded the aspect of functional differentiation as an indispensable component of secularization, in his more recent work he has increasingly characterized this too as a genuinely Western development in the light of European history and its confrontation between temporal and sacred authority. Therefore, he has questioned the transferability of the concept to other regions and religions. The critique of classical secularization theory can be heightened into three fundamental objections. These concern its alleged universalism, its underlying process theory, and its modernist normative bias. Overall, however, I would say these critiques themselves are far from being not normative. While the secularization paradigm is often considered as Eurocentric and anti-religious, recent research generally fashions itself as sympathetic towards religion. As compared to the older debate, recent contributions often engender an inversion of the subject and object of the critique. Whereas secularism used to be regarded as a means of liberation from the constraints of traditional religious authority, religion now tends to appear as a space of freedom, and secularism itself as an instrument of regimentation and of exclusion. The critique of secularization theory has certainly increased the sensitivity to cultural differences and unjustified generalizations. However, I would say there is now a danger of an essentialism of historically unique developments and a danger of undue generalizations about the ideological power of Western secularism. Given this situation, I think that the discussion of secularization in sociology could benefit from the recent debates in the theory of modernity, in particular from the multiple modernities approach. This approach insists on the indispensability of the concept of modernity, but without persisting in its one-sided orientation to a seemingly universal Western model. Against this backdrop, I propose taking into account, on the one hand, the cultural pathways of secularity and their conditions, and on the other, the history of interaction between different models of secularity. It is self-evident for such an approach, the contributions of different area studies and of history are at least as important as the systematizing attempts of the social sciences. Let me now go into the use of the concept of multiple secularities and of secularity as such. The dominant concepts in the current international debates are not secularity, but rather secularization and secularism. Whereas the concept of secularization is used primarily in sociological process models, addressing processes of functional differentiation, religious decline, and privatization of religious practice, secularism refers to the arrangements of the institutional separation of politics or the state and religion, as well as to their ideological legitimizations. For reason of analytical clarity in what follows, I propose to reserve the concept of secularism for the ideological philosophical program, hence for the explicit ideology of separation and its related political practices. The concept of secularity, by contrast, for the institutionally as well as culturally and symbolically anchored forms and arrangements of differentiation between religion and other social spheres or practices. Therefore, the concept of secularity is meant to be more inclusive than, is meant to be more inclusive than that of secularism, and also encompasses the at times latent, taken for granted forms of the distinction between the religious and the non-religious. In addition, I expressly do not confine the analysis to the relation between the state and religion, but include other functional domains of society as well. For instance, those of law, education, science, business, and others, as well as the public sphere. The connection between such religious secular distinctions and their legitimizing guiding ideas differs empirically. One can assume that the corresponding divisions develop a specific cultural dynamic where they are not only implicitly practiced, but are made explicit and become condensed into guiding ideas, as was also the case with the guiding ideas of modernity and progress. It seems evident from this perspective that the rejection of concepts such as secularization and secularism in large parts of the Islamic world, and we heard about this in the last lecture, is not necessarily bound up with the absence of differentiations between the religious and the secular, hence with the omnipresence of religion. My assumption is rather that there are no readily accessible guiding ideas of secularity with which such distinctions could be legitimized. In addition, Islam represents an essential code of cultural identity, especially in the Arab world, with its history of belated nation-state formations. The history of the resonance between the Western and the non-Western world is in this sense reflected primarily in the negative relation to a form of secularity that is perceived as ideological secularism, which is associated with hostility to religion and with atheism. This does not preclude, however, de facto differentiations in the area of education, science, business, law, as well as politics. The analytical distinction between ideologies of separation and practices of differentiation also opens our eyes for pre-modern practices that provide intellectual resources and thereby pave the way for modern forms of secularity. Rajiv Bhargav has worked about this for the Indian case. Without themselves already being associated with secular guiding ideas, pre-modern regimes of toleration in different parts of the world could be an example of this. Now I come to this. By multiple secularities, in what follows, I mean the forms of distinction between the religious and other social domains or practices which are thereby marked as non-religious. Forms of distinctions that are institutionalized and in part, not always, legitimized through guiding ideas. I assume that these secularities exhibit different cultural logics that document a specific social history of conflict no less than the competing influence of other forms of secularity, as may happen through colonial encounters. I assume further that the multiple secularities that are taking shape in different countries and regions respond to specific societal problems as their reference problems, that they identify such problems and frame them and offer solutions to them. Obviously, these problems arise at some point and in some form in many societies, but they come up with different degrees of urgency at different points in time, and they are framed in different ways. At a first approximation in the project I mentioned, we have identified four such reference problems. The problem of individual freedom vis-à-vis dominant social units, may they be groups or the state. Second, the problem of religious heterogeneity and the resulting potential or actual conflictuality. Third, the problem of social or national integration and development. And fourth, the problem of the independent development of institutional domains. It is clear that most of these problems are closely associated to the formation of modern societies and states and the ideas on which they are founded, whereas at least the second also arises in pre-modern societies. And I think it's no accident that reflections on pre-modern sources of modern secularity generally begin here, and I again mention Rajiv Barlow. These four central problems provide motives for institutionalizing distinctions between the religious and other social spheres. As latent motives and social practices, they can certainly coexist. As overt motifs, they may compete with each other. My assumption is, however, that some of them may become dominant given certain preconditions by being aligned with a guiding idea that sets the basic terms for distinguishing religious and secular spaces in a given society, and thereby pushes the other motifs, at least at times, to the background. And this may be then the link between secularity and secularism. There is no doubt, however, that these motifs are often highly contested. Accordingly, my claim is not that such a basic tenor of secularity can be identified in every society, or that just one of the motives matters. The following restrictions are conceivable. First, the practices of differentiation may remain below the threshold at which guiding ideas are formulated. I think an example of this would be parts of the Islamic world. Second, different concepts of secularity and guiding ideas may compete with each other. The situation seems to exist in a whole range of post-colonial countries, for example in South Africa, but also in many Western societies during phases of transition. Third, the guiding idea can be the ideology of elites that diverges from the dominant social practices of differentiation, as with the secularist reforms of Kemal Atatürk, which today are patently in conflict with the Islamic self-understanding of large parts of the population. And finally, it is also possible that the problems in question are not resolved in the direction of secularity, but through the imposition of religious authority, so that secularity remains in the background as a latent option. Let me add one word on the use of sociological ideal types, which may be a risky enterprise in an interdisciplinarity environment. From my point of view, the development of ideal types, which is obviously borrowed from Weber, ideal types of secularity should support the work on concrete historical cases, but it must not conflate the differences between ideal types in the Weberian sense and specific national or regional variations. Ideal types are analytical abstractions that are developed from empirical and historical data and mirror back on them to guide the construction of hypotheses and theorization. Real constellations will always differ from ideal types, but at least this is what we hope. The latter could help to better examine the former. So when I speak of ideal types, I do not mean boxes in which we put countries, but rather analytical instruments that help us to understand what's going on in these countries. Relating back to the four reference problems that I have already introduced, in the project we have distinguished between the following forms of secularity. Secularity for the sake of individual rights and liberties, for the sake of balancing or pacifying religious differences, for the sake of societal or national integration and development, and finally, secularity for the sake of the independent development of functional domains. These four basic forms of secularity are associated with different guiding ideas. In the first case, it is a guiding idea of freedom and individuality. In the second, that of toleration and respect. whereas the third case involves the ideas of progress and enlightenment, and the fourth case, finally, involves the guiding ideas of rationality, efficiency, and autonomy. Abstracting even further, the underlying references in the field of tension that they constitute can be represented as follows. So the individual, the groups, society or nation, and functional domains. Depending on which reference problem dominates, a certain tension vis-à-vis the other references is created. For example, prioritizing the balance between religious groups is likely to create tensions with regard to individual liberty, rights to the pursuit of national interests, as well as to guaranteeing the autonomy of functional domains. I would now like to try to land this model plausibility with reference to selected countries. This reference has primarily illustrative character and cannot serve as a substitute for in-depth studies. The primary emphasis is on describing the model. On top, in what follows, I will highlight the predominance of one type of secularity and thereby present the cases in a pointed manner. It will become evident that this does not mean that the other types of secularity are not present or might not gain importance in the future. I even suggest that all forms of secularity are in fact available in the stock of knowledge of modern societies due to their global interconnectedness. If they become dominant or remain a background option, if they find support or are highly contested, however, depends on the specific constellation and on the cultural history to which it can be related. And now I go into some illustrations with reference to different countries. Start with the first, secularity for the sake of individual liberty. The motif of liberty, the freedom of a Christian, was a central concern in the Protestant Reformation and is closely linked to Luther's two kingdoms theory. Both became important points of reference for later justifications of the separation of church and state. The Lutheran concept of the freedom of conscience also gained influence upon Western concepts of individuality and the autonomy of man. The motif of liberty of conscience also was important for early Enlightenment thinkers, as is visible in John Locke's letter concerning toleration from 1689. It became influential for the developments towards the separation of church and state and their intellectual grounding in Europe, as well as in the United States. In spite of the coexistence of several concerns motivating the separation of church and state in the US, the motif of liberty, mostly in close connection with religion, obviously served as a guiding idea under which different interests were able to coalesce. In her study Roads to Modernity, US historian Gertrude Himmelfarb demarcates the American Enlightenment from its European variants. Although rooted in British intellectual history, she sees the American Enlightenment as being founded centrally on the motive of political liberty. Notwithstanding its centering on the value of liberty, American history is replete with struggles over its very meaning. That a clear separation between the state and religion and religious communities was anchored in the First Amendment was a result of a coalition between two very different groups, strict secularists as well as religious dissidents. From this point of view, inherent in American secularity from the beginning were two sets of motifs that found a shared basis in the notion of individual liberty, though this did not prevent the tension between the motivations from breaking out repeatedly. That disestablishment can be interpreted in different ways and that the wall of separation is by no means uncontested is shown by a multitude of controversies over the place of religion in the public sphere. However, controversies over religious clothing and over the wearing of religious symbols in public, such as are currently observable in various European countries, are scarcely imaginable in the United States. Conversely, actions such as the public burning of a Quran by a Protestant minister are not and are not expected to be curtailed for the sake of balancing group interests, with major consequences worldwide. This is not to say that other guiding ideas did not exist. Equality in terms of guaranteeing the rights of religious and other minorities is certainly one of them. And the often heard slogan of celebrating diversity expresses this idea until the present. The ideological struggles that started in 1800 with the election debates between the Republican Party of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams' Federalist Party also conveyed the notion of secularity for the sake of societal progress. In spite of diverging interests, the motif of liberty, however, could unfold the strongest unifying force. A clear contrast to the American model, both historically and in the present, is the French concept of secularity. Although the motif of liberty was also central to the French Revolution, the two countries differ fundamentally. In our opinion, the difference is not only, as Cady and Hurd have put it, that the pursuit of liberty in France stood in opposition to religious freedom and not in collusion with it. It also consists in the fact that in France, the rhetoric of liberty ties into a national republican program, whereas in the US, it is more individualistically inflected. While in the US, liberty is all about limiting state power over individuals, in France, it's rather a property of the collectivity. Historically, this difference is reflected in the American understanding of the French Revolution. In the present, it finds expression in the American way of organizing religious diversity. So even if similar semantics exist in a variety of contexts, the reference problem that they are related to may give them a very different connotation. However, recent history also shows that liberty or freedom can also become an ideological emblem of nationalism in the United States, as for example, in the rhetorical legitimation of the Iraq War, carried out as it was under the motto Enduring Freedom. Let me move to the second type. The motive of secularity for the sake of pacifying religious diversity played an important role in a variety of countries that had to grapple with unrest and violence between different religious and confessional groups. The European religious wars were an influential historical experience for this motive. One of the places in Europe where it became most influential and was expressed in elaborate concepts of tolerance are the Netherlands. Here the motive of balancing diversity later became institutionalized in the pillar structure as a characteristic model for the Dutch way of dealing with religious and ideological diversity. In more recent times, however, the situation in the Netherlands has changed significantly, which, as we would interpret it, has led to a shift in the dominant motive of secularity towards the third type. The changing motifs in the quarrel about ritual slaughter, for example, since the early 20th century indicates this shift very clearly. The country in which the impact of the type of secularity that serves to balance and pacify diversity is especially strong is India, and we have already heard about this in the previous lecture. Even though secularism was only explicitly incorporated in the Indian constitution in 1976, it played a central role already in the constituent assembly debates from 46 to 49. As Roshana Bajpai has shown in her analysis of the constituent assembly debates, as well as of the Lok Sabha debates on the Shabano case in the 1980s, the connotations of secularism in India have changed significantly. A quote from Bajpai: "Secularism in the Shabano case debate was defined primarily in terms of state deference to religion and protection of the rights of minorities, rather than in the dominant terms of the Constituent Assembly debates, those of equal citizenship, rights for individuals, and the exclusion of religion from the political domain." According to her analysis, rights increasingly tended to be interpreted as group rights, and religious freedom was more and more understood as the freedom of religious communities from state interference rather than the individual freedom to choose or reject a religion. With the government's decision in favor of a secular penal code on the one hand, and of religiously grounded civil status rights on the other, India has engendered tensions between universalistic and group-specific law, in which secularity and religion maintain a precarious balance. If one speaks with Indian scholars, politicians, and intellectuals from different backgrounds, the almost unanimous view is that Indian secularity or secularism is not about the separation between state and religion, and certainly not about anti-religious attitudes of any kind. In debates over secularism, the Indian case is contrasted to both the American wall of separation and French laicism, which are often identified as essential variants of the Western model and are rejected by many. Instead, it is claimed that Indian secularism stands for the equal distance of the state from the groups, but above all for respect toward religious minorities. Moreover, the state is supposed to ensure the balance between groups in order to avoid social unrest and maintain public order. The idea of accommodating religious diversity as key to Indian secularity can be shown to hold for both critics and advocates. Advocates support this reading by referring to indigenous developments in pre-modern India that they claim provided the conceptual tools of Indian secularity. And I again mention Rajiv Bhargav, who is an activist as well as a researcher in this respect. Others regard it as a fundamental political malaise that poses a major obstacle to the pursuit of national interests, and the position of the Hindu nationalists can be mentioned here. This becomes especially apparent in the arguments over the implementation of a uniform civil code, which is foreseen in the Indian constitution but has not been realized to date. The existence of an Islamic civil status law is regarded above all by Islamic groups as a symbol of recognition as a minority. As a consequence, attacks on this element of legal pluralism are eyed with great suspicion. For other groups, however, like the RSS, but also for so-called rationalist groups, the non-realization of a uniform civil code is a symptom of India's falling apart into group interests. Focusing on the problems of balancing religious diversity and the relation between majorities and minorities means that other aspects command less attention. For example, individual freedom of religion or the freedom to criticize religion. Thus, already shortly after the appearance of Salman Rushdie's book, The Satanic Verses, the Indian government decided to ban it, even though there had been no significant protest by Muslim groups at that time. The protest against the banning of the book also remained within limits. Issues of the autonomy of institutional spheres of society, I would say, also take a back seat when it comes to ensuring the balance between the religious communities. Again, this seems to be especially apparent in the legal domain. Emblematic of this is a recent court decision handed down in the case concerning the land claims of two Hindu groups and one Muslim group to the compound in Ayodhya. In this compound stood the Babri Mosque, which was later destroyed by Hindu nationalists, which supposedly had been erected on a site of a former temple to Ram. Many Hindu groups regard this as the birthplace of the god Ram and assume that the temple was destroyed when the mosque was erected. Two things I would say stand out in the recent court judgment as regards secularity in India. On the one hand, one of the judges, Sudhir Agarwal, argued that the place of the mosque was in fact the birthplace of Ram. Adopting such an avowedly religious perspective, he clearly transgressed the limits of his secular judicial authority. Numerous commentators have criticized this view and have held the judgment to be juridically inadmissible and conjectured that it would not stand up in appeal proceedings. Simultaneously, however, the decision to accord each of the three parties to the suit one-third of the compound was regarded as a wise judgment on the model of familial or village conflict mediation. One could conclude from that that the pacifying argument has the upper hand over the autonomy of the domain of law. Clearly, the fact that the administration of justice strayed into the religious domain is not really disconcerting in the Indian context. Much more disconcerting would be a decision that would ignore the imperative of preserving the balance between religions. And move to the third type. We find this type of secularity where the guiding idea is closely allied with national interests and takes precedence over the balance between groups or over individual freedom. This is encountered in France, for example, where the republican motif is intimately bound up with the principle of laïcité and is simultaneously associated with the expectation that imported cultural and religious differences among the population should be treated as private matters. This finds its culmination for the present in the total prohibition on wearing the burqa in public, which makes clear that what is at stake here is not only the separation between state and religion, but also the defense of the broad program in the wider public domain. Some of the socialist dictatorships, though not all, can be subsumed in this logic as well. For example, the official GDR doctrine of scientific atheism involved the curtailing of churches' influence and religious freedom. By repressively imposing secularist rituals such as a youth initiation ceremony, the state achieved a significant reduction in religious participation. Protagonists of the ruling party explicitly legitimized anti-church activities such as the blasting of the Leipzig University Church in 1968 in terms of social progress. East German secularism, however, did not remain an elite project alone. Surveys have shown remarkable support for the idea that religious and rational perspectives are incompatible, and 20 years after the end of the GDR, the eastern part of Germany is still the most secularized region in the world. Other post-socialist countries show different developments. It would be too easy, however, to simply tell a story of socialist repression of religion and post-socialist religious revival. As Engelhardt's cultural map indicates, some of the communist regimes were able to leave a lasting imprint on their population's perspectives on religion and to shape long-lasting secular habits. Further research is still needed to identify to what degree the secularism in communist societies remained only on the level of political ideology and repressive practices, and to what degree it was actually able to create a long-lasting culture of secularity, even if some religious rituals and practices may have been revived after the fall of communism. I now come briefly to the last type. This fourth type is intimately bound up with the notion of social differentiation, and hence with one of the key concepts of sociology. Here we are concerned with processes of differentiation between religion and other social domains. For example, in the form of the emancipation of institutional domains from ecclesiastical control. Through processes of differentiation, secular spaces are defined and developmental possibilities released that are no longer controlled by religion but conform to rationalities of their own. The converse also holds true for the domain of religion. Historically, it seems that pioneering champions of the autonomy of education, medicine, and law from religious guidelines frequently conducted their struggles in the name of progress and modernity. This seems to suggest that there is a major overlap between this type and the above-mentioned model of secularity for the sake of social progress. On a closer inspection, however, the situation proves to be more differentiated. In Europe, a strong association between the domains of science, education, and art in particular, and the commitment and support on the part of the churches used to exist. Here, a de facto differentiation between the perspectives predefined by ecclesiastical dogmas and a scientific perspective that liberates itself from the latter arose in part through the concrete work on the object, as for example in the case of Galileo Galilei, free from any secularistic impetus. Something similar occurred in the domain of ecclesiastic art or in the domain of law. A further difference between this logic and the one treated before is the fact that here it is less a matter of incorporating forms of differentiation into a program affecting society as a whole, and also less a matter of the devaluation of religion that accompanies national secularist ideologies of progress in principle. Here, the central focus is more on effecting a dislocation of religion that can take place primarily in societies hitherto characterized by a comprehensive religious monopoly of power and interpretation that proves to be limiting or inefficient for certain professions. It is quite seldom that secularity, for the sake of the autonomous development of institutional domains, becomes the dominant pattern of an entire society and subordinates other motives for secularity. It is rather documented in a multiplicity of arenas and developments that, taken as a whole, exhibit the same thrust. In these arenas, however, the other motivations discussed recede into the background. I come to an end. The concept of multiple secularities rests on the recognition that the notions of the secular, of secularism and secularity, are charged with highly divergent meanings that are linked to different political and cultural contexts and histories of social conflict. Even though these histories inevitably give rise to different social dynamics, they always focus on specific ways of drawing boundaries between religion and other spheres of social practice. I have construed these ways in terms of four ideal types, specifying historical reference problems, guiding ideas, and historical solutions. Taken together, these aspects form what we have called the cultural logics of secularity. This means the ways in which the relationships between religion and other spheres are organized according to models that have become dominant at the expense of others, or which conflict with other models. I have illustrated these logics through different regional scenarios and indicated how these might change. On the one hand, this conceptualization thus acknowledges the divergent structures of meaning that crystallize in the notion of the secular in different societies. On the other hand, I argue that these differences do not imply that the transformations of the social location of religion unfold as incomparable processes. Research based on this conceptualization would need to identify the social mechanisms and power relations through which particular logics and understandings of secularity become dominant while others become marginalized or remain insignificant. In addition, it would also need to examine the ways in which particular practices, symbols, and beliefs are publicly recognized as religion and are thereby drawn into the dynamics and logics of secularity. Thank you.